From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. We're following breaking news from London, where police are dealing with a terrorist attack today on London Bridge. A number of people were stabbed, and a man with a hoax explosive device on his chest was shot and killed by police. Prime Minister Boris Johnson returned to his office at No. 10 Downing Street to monitor the situation. And the incident comes less than 2 weeks before the British election and ahead of a NATO summit in London next week. Joining us now is BBC security correspondent Frank Gardner. Frank, this started around 2 p.m. London time. What more do we know about what happened?
The events unfolded very quickly indeed. This man had a very large knife indeed, measuring, well, at least 8 inches from what I can see from the video footage. And he lashed out at a number of people. Several people have been injured, but so far no reports of any fatalities other than the suspect himself. He was overpowered by pedestrians on this bridge. This is London Bridge, is quite a well-known landmark in London, and it's also the scene of an earlier terrorist attack about 2 years ago. And they dived onto him, at which point police turned up, armed police, and they shouted instructions. People moved off him. And in fact, you can actually see in one video police dragging somebody off the suspect, at which point the suspect did something that made the police fire their weapons. A single shot was fired, and they've confirmed that he was shot dead at the scene. He died of his injuries at the scene. They almost certainly shot him because he appeared to be carrying an explosive device, an improvised explosive device, which they've now said was a hoax. It was a dummy device. So they weren't taking any chances there. They would have shot him to prevent him from activating a device. So this is being treated as a terrorist incident. They've not released the identity. When I spoke to officials, they didn't know the identity of the suspect. It's not an intelligence-led police operation. In other words, this was an entirely reactive, spontaneous police action reacting to something that suddenly happened with no warning.
Well, and you mentioned the attack in 2017 on London Bridge. There was also an attack on Westminster Bridge, another bridge crossing the Thames in London. These attacks must be on everybody's minds as they watch what's happening today.
They must. And it's I have to say, surprising to some people in counterterrorism that somebody would choose yet again a bridge, a London Bridge. I mean, since that attack in 2017 on London Bridge, they've put in precautionary measures there. They've put in like a guardrail so that nobody could actually drive off in a van, say, off the road part of it onto the pavement and crush pedestrians. So they've put in precautionary measures. And yet, once again, a bridge is being used as some kind of an attack. Now, in the last few weeks, Britain lowered its national terrorism threat level to what's called substantial. We have a kind of grading system of five here, the highest being critical and then severe and then substantial. And so it was lowered from severe down to substantial, still meaning that a terrorist attack is possible, but not as likely as it was. So I think there will be some people now wondering whether they should raise it back up. The immediate priority, of course, is to secure the area, and that the police have done that. They've put a cordon around it. They've evacuated a number of premises nearby. They've put up cordons that are going to stay in place for some time. But the immediate priority is to find out who this attacker was, who he knew, what was his motivation. Had he been anywhere? You know, they will be searching his home and looking at his digital footprint.
And Frank, this comes less than 2 weeks before an election in the UK. And also, as we mentioned, this NATO summit happening in London next week. Does this change anything in terms of the dynamic for the election, do you think?
I don't think it will. I mean, the Conservative Party, which is in the lead in the polls at the moment, they like to say that they are tough on crime. But under their government, around 20,000 police officers were cut. So the police are understaffed in this country. So they like to say normally that they are strong on law and order. And certainly Priti Patel, who is the what's called the Home Secretary, the kind of interior minister here, I guess you could call her, she's the nearest thing to kind of Homeland Security chief. She has a reputation for being pretty tough on terrorism and security. And in fact, there is talk of extending sentences for some people. So I don't think it'll have an immediate bearing on it. All parties will condemn what's happened. You know, there's no no sympathy for terrorism, I don't think, in any parties in this competing in this election.
That's BBC security correspondent Frank Gardner in London. Frank, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, this week, that bomb cyclone that hit the West Coast brought hurricane-force winds and one gust in Oregon of 106 miles per hour. It's just one storm, but it's also part of a trend. The world is getting windier. A new study in the journal Nature Climate Change says global wind speeds have risen dramatically over the past 10 years. Joining us now is one of the co-authors of the study, Timothy Searchinger. He's a research scholar at Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
So tell us what your study found exactly.
Well, it found three things. One is that there has been a clear belief that there has been a slowing of global wind speed from 1980 on that has been a source of concern because it means unknown changes in the global climate system and also because it means lower wind power. But one thing we showed was that actually that reversed in 2010 and has increased significantly to 2017, and we expect it to continue to increase.
How do you measure that?
Well, that's actually a big complication. There are wind measuring systems, wind monitors in various places around the world at different elevations. And because they have differing quality and because they have differing biases, heights, whatever, you have to do a lot of statistical analyses to make sure that when you're combining them together, you're getting an accurate picture.
But you're pretty confident that at this point, winds are getting faster than they were at least in 2010 or in the period between 1980 and 2010.
Correct. And a big part of the paper was doing a wide variety of statistical tests to demonstrate that. And it's demonstrated, I think, quite convincingly.
And what's the effect of it?
One effect is on our wind power. So the wind generation in turbines is a cubic function of wind speed. So when you increase the wind speed by a little bit, you still increase the power quite a lot. And also you can cut off these periods when wind is too slow to actually generate power. So as a result, the average wind turbine in the world would be able to generate about 17% more electricity in 2017 than it did in 2010. So that's one big effect. Another thing the paper showed is that the explanations of the global – it's called global stilling were incorrect, which is good news. So there was a belief that actually kind of increased numbers of buildings, actually in some places increased vegetation was causing a kind of a surface roughness that was kind of a barrier to wind speeds and it was slowing winds down.
That humans were slowing the winds down basically.
That humans were slowing the winds down. And what this paper showed is that's actually not the case. What it is influencing wind speeds are these – they're called ocean oscillations, which are different patterns of pressure and temperature and winds in different parts of the ocean that go through these sometimes irregular but recurring patterns. So that's good that it's not humans causing this permanent change. And we're able to benefit from the increasing wind speed now and probably at least for the next decade. But it also means that at some point or other, we will get a stilling effect again.
So humans are not causing the change in wind speeds based on the buildings that we have up all around the world. But is human-driven climate change causing the increase in wind speeds?
Well, this study wouldn't show that. This study would show it's more due to these regular oscillation patterns, these recurring patterns of where pressure is and ocean temperatures are. But it is possible that there is some effect from climate change. It's just that we didn't try to tease that out in this paper.
So let's talk about what it means for wind energy. You said that the increase in wind speeds explains half the increase in U.S. wind capacity factor since 2010. Is that significant enough that it will really spur the United States to push forward in wind energy in a way that it has not yet done?
I'm not sure it's going to have a gigantic policy effect, but what it does have is an engineering effect. It means that when you size wind turbines, you can size them differently to take advantage of that additional power. That's really the key point, is that if we can predict these changing patterns 10 years in advance. We can size our turbines so that they take advantage of the maximum amount of wind that is reasonable and economical. So, for example, if we'd known in 2010 that the speed was going to pick up, we could have built slightly larger turbines that would have therefore captured even more energy.
That is Timothy Searchinger, who's one of the co-authors of a new study that found global wind speeds have increased. He is a research scholar at Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School. Thanks for joining us.
Very happy to be here.
Hi, it's Robin Young, thanking you for listening to the Here and Now podcast and inviting you to contribute to support it at donate.npr.org/now. For all the reasons that you listen, Here Now helps you make sense of the world, and when you donate to your NPR station, you're supporting the journalism that brings context and perspective to the news and conversations with people making a difference in the arts, music, and culture. So please, make a donation to your NPR station today, and that investment will come right back to your ears. Just go to donate.npr.org/now. We're building NPR and its member stations. Thanks to you. Now, let's get back to the news.
This is Here and Now. As Americans were celebrating Thanksgiving, North Korea was testing a large multiple rocket launcher, firing two short-range missiles into the sea. North Korea and the U.S. have been unable to make progress on a deal that would reduce economic sanctions on North Korea in exchange for North Korea abandoning its nuclear ambitions. We're joined now by NPR correspondent Anthony Kuhn in Seoul, South Korea. Anthony, welcome.
Hey, Jeremy.
So President Trump and the North Korean leader Kim Jong-un have been back and forth on nuclear talks for a long time now. Where are we with the situation at this moment?
One way of looking at it is that we are 30 plus days before the year's end and a North Korean deadline. Kim Jong-un has basically said if the U.S. does not offer up fresh concessions by the end of the year, he may just give up on nuclear negotiations with the U.S. altogether and go back to testing nuclear weapons and missiles. And that is, needless to say, very worrisome. That takes us back to where we were in 2017.
Except that there will have already been a couple of visits with the president of the United States, which is a change from where we were before that in terms of the relationship with North Korea. They've already gotten something that they wanted.
That's right. The sort of nuclear brinkmanship was in 2017 with Trump threats of fire and fury. Then that was followed by a year of diplomatic breakthroughs, starting with the U.S.-North Korea summit in Singapore in 2018, and then three inter-Korean summits. And then this year, a summit between Trump and Kim again in Hanoi in February that fell apart, and a Trump and Kim meeting at the demilitarized zone between the two Koreas in which President Trump actually stepped into North Korea. Now, talks have been stalled most of the rest of the year through that. Working level negotiations resumed in Stockholm last month, but they quickly fell apart.
Do you think that before the end of the year that a deal or another nuclear summit with President Trump looks likely?
Looks like a very long shot at this point. The U.S. is saying, we didn't make this deadline. It's got nothing to do with us. North Korea put that deadline on itself. And North Korea is saying, you know, we don't want a summit if it's just going to be a formality. We don't want any sort of meeting that doesn't give us concrete benefits. So they seem to have made the preparations to just let the clock run out, possibly on the year and possibly on the entire Trump administration. They may just wait until the next one.
Well, and Anthony, if this whole process after all this time and all this work fails, what's going to be the reason for that?
Well, the two sides just had a completely different view of, you know, what the end goal was. The U.S. has always seen complete, irreversible, and verifiable denuclearization as the final state. North Korea intends to hang on to its weapons, but perhaps freeze them or give away a part of them in exchange for sanctions relief and some security guarantees. So they're starting out from different objectives, and they're you know, they just have not narrowed the differences through talks.
And obviously, a big part of the equation is South Korea. And I want to ask you about that. The U.S. is asking South Korea to pitch in $5 billion next year for U.S. troops that are stationed in the country, have been stationed in the country for a long time. South Korea paid less than $1 billion this year. How did the U.S. and South Korea get into this tiff?
Well, there were talks, but the two sides' positions were so far apart that the U.S. walked out on its ally and the talks collapsed. Hmm. Now, the Trump administration wants all of its allies to pay more, and South Korea is first in its sights, and then they're going to try the same thing on Japan and probably allies in Europe. And President Trump has suggested that some of the 28,500 troops here in this country could be withdrawn if Seoul does not pay up. Actually, Congress passed a law saying that the president can only take out a few thousand troops, beyond which he needs to get the Secretary of Defense to certify that that's actually in the nation's security interest to do. What people in South Korea are saying is that the U.S. has not been clear about how this $5 billion breaks down or what the rationale for it is. And if it turns out that what they're asking for is actually more than the cost of basing those troops then critics are going to accuse the U.S. of treating its allies as cash cows, mm-hmm. treating alliances as sort of for-profit enterprises, and treating U.S. troops as mercenaries.
So does it seem likely, I'll ask you the same question I did about North Korea, does it seem likely that the U.S. and South Korea are going to agree on a deal here?
Well, I think a deal is possible. You know, we don't know if the U.S. really expects to get $5 billion or if it's just a sort of a bargaining ploy and they'll settle for two or three. Last year, they asked for a 50% increase and they got an 8% increase. Hmm. And that is because South Korea is a democratic country. Any deal that is made has to be ratified by lawmakers, by their national legislature. And they got this 8% increase because the legislators said, well, that's what we're going to increase our national defense budget by. So that's okay. But this time, lawmakers have said, if this deal is not fair, we're not going to ratify it.
You just visited Camp Humphreys, which is at the heart of a lot of the cost-sharing issue. It's the largest U.S. military base on the peninsula. It's actually the largest U.S. base outside of the United States. What did you find there?
I found Popeyes, I found Arby's, I found 24-hour gyms, I found modern three-bedroom apartments for military families. I found a place that could look, very much like any town USA. Hmm. So this place is an area the size of downtown Washington, D.C. It just goes on. And in the event of another war with North Korea, this would become a massive staging base for moving troops and equipment onto the peninsula. And it's about an hour's drive south of Seoul in a city called Pyeongtaek, which is now really taking off with this base there. What I also saw was that this gigantic base is now a big fat target. When they made the decision to move to Camp Humphreys more than a decade ago, North Korean artillery and rockets couldn't hit it. Now they can hit just about anything on the entire peninsula. So the move seems like a good decision for peacetime. You get economies of scale. You save money on logistics. You get better living conditions from the soldiers. But, you know, it is a big fat target, and the U.S. really can only rely on deterrence to keep it from getting hit.
Hmm. Now, I want to just ask you, Anthony, because before moving to Seoul, you spent many years as NPR's correspondent in Beijing. And there's been so much going on in China recently. Let me first ask you what you make of the developments in Hong Kong with these pro-democracy protesters. It's been going on for months now, demanding that they get to keep and even expand the democratic aspect of their society. And Beijing really wants to move them closer to how the rest of China is.
Yeah, that's right. I was there for reporting mostly during June and August, and that was when you had the biggest marches, when they got as many as 2 million people into the streets of Hong Kong, and it was all nonviolent. And I think that's what, up until now, has had the biggest political impact and led to the withdrawal of this extradition bill that was the immediate cause of the protests. Now things are a lot more desperate and a lot more violent. No side shows any sign of giving in. I think everybody agrees that the matter can only be solved through political negotiations, not street violence, not law enforcement, but it's not happening. Now, some people may say, well, the only thing Beijing can do is intervene militarily, and that would be too much of a blot on their international reputation. But think about 1989 and Tiananmen Square. If they feel that their survival as a regime is threatened, they'll take the blot on their international reputation and put the protest down. No hesitation.
Okay. Well, speaking of Beijing feeling like their regime is threatened, let's talk finally about the Uyghurs. These are Muslims living in the Xinjiang region of China, and Beijing has been putting them into camps and prisons over the last 3 years, a million of them. Is this a human rights tragedy unfolding before our very eyes?
It certainly is, but in a sense, it's bigger than that. In a sense, it really is like Hong Kong. Both of them are regions on China's periphery. Both of them have pro-independence movements that Beijing is very worried about, and both of them are, in a sense, minorities. The Uyghurs speak a sort of Turkic language, and people in Hong Kong, many of them speak Cantonese. Documents obtained by the New York Times make clear that this was indeed a very sweeping campaign targeting Islamic extremism. Orders were given to round up whoever needs to be round up. This came from the very top of the system, President and party boss Xi Jinping, and that Xi Jinping had some really ideological goals in mind. And there are other countries that target radicalism and try to deprogram radicals. But as the report from the New York Times made clear, they tried to treat extremism as a disease and cure people of it. And this happened with apparently a lack of due process in violation of China's own laws outside the court system. And it appeared to make no distinction between radical Islam and simple religious devotion expressed in things such as praying five times a day, eating halal, or wearing veils and growing beards.
Well, and I was asking an expert here in the U.S. about it recently, and I asked, you know, if the United States really put pressure on China to back off in Xinjiang, would they do it? And he said, no, they don't care. This is about their regime and their power all across the country in China.
Yeah. And as I said, like Hong Kong, they're concerned about an independence movement there. It's a cultural minority. It's a linguistic minority. It has not always been part of the Chinese nation. So that's a matter of sovereignty and regime survival to them.
That is NPR's Anthony Kuhn, who was the correspondent in China and is now based in Seoul, South Korea. Anthony, thanks so much.
My pleasure, Jeremy.
It is Black Friday, but the lines at many stores may not be as long as consumers look for deals online instead. The data firm Adobe Analytics says online sales yesterday were up 20% from a year ago, and almost half of those purchases were made on mobile devices. Americans are expected to spend an average of $637 per person this holiday season, according to one estimate. For more, let's go to Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Jill, thanks for joining us.
Oh, great to be with you.
Okay, so $637 per person on average. Does that strike you as a lot or a little?
You know, I guess it depends. You know, we always read those scary reports about how Americans don't have $400 to pay for an emergency expense. And so when I see $600, I'm like, that seems like a lot considering that. On the other hand, if you're cooking a big dinner and you're going out and spending some money, that money does add up. So obviously, we hope that everyone spends within his or her means, but don't go nutty out there.
Well, and I always tell people that the number one piece of financial advice that I got many years ago, and I think it is so dead on, is pay off your credit card bill every month if you can, because you're just wasting your money on these extremely high interest payments if you don't do that. Is there ever a situation, Jill, where you would say, okay, fine, go ahead and run up some debt on your credit card bill for Christmas presents or holiday presents?
I'll tell you a couple of reasons why I think it's a bad idea. Number one is many people will do this. They'll say, you know what? I'm going to get a tax refund. So I'll run up a card. Don't do that. First of all, you don't know. You're not running your estimated taxes, and you probably may find that it's not enough money to pay off the bill. But I think more importantly, It is about your habits and the way you form those habits. And so as you say that if you can use a credit card responsibly, fantastic, that's great, pay it off every month. But if you're the kind of person, you know yourself, then what you try to do is you avoid actually putting it on the credit card. And this is akin to saying, well, I'll speak for myself. Hey, I really like chocolate chip cookies. I am not going to have chocolate chip cookies in my house because I know that's too tempting
right.
for me.
Right. I agree with you 100% about chocolate chip cookies.
Good. We're on the same page.
Any other holiday shopping tips, Jill?
There are so many ways to kind of deal with the holidays in such a smart way. I think it's just taking advantage of it. So technology has been really great. And you can get organized and download various apps that they allow you to scan barcodes of products and compare prices. They're all out there. The question is, will you actually use them? And maybe this is the year where you say to yourself, wait a second. I remember when Jeremy and Jill were talking and they kept talking about not so much a spending beyond our means, but spending on experience. And what we do know about the holidays and gift giving in general is people don't remember the gift you've given. They remember the experience. So maybe your gift to your niece or your nephew is, we're going out and we're doing something fun. We're going to the zoo. It's something like that. It doesn't have to break the bank.
And also, it could be really something that you make for someone. A photo album or something like that might be much more memorable than an Apple Watch.
You know, that is such a great point, and I've just come up with what you should make me.
Oh, what do you want?
Chocolate chip cookies, obviously.
Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money, and apparently still hungry post-Thanksgiving. Jill, thank you.
Take care.
Officials in southeast Texas say a massive chemical plant fire has been contained and they've lifted an evacuation order for around 50,000 people. Residents in and around the city of Port Neches were told to leave on Wednesday after a large explosion tore through the TPC Group chemical plant 80 miles east of Houston. A home security camera captured the blast in the middle of the night. Three workers at the plant were injured. All have since been released from the hospital. The blast blew out windows of nearby houses, ripped doors off their hinges, and cracked walls and ceilings. Mike Tobias works for the school district and spoke with ABC News.
You saw the light and you felt the house rattle. About a second or two later, a shockwave sort of hit the house. It was very loud, mainly because the front door blew in. And the door frame blew out. So at that point, I thought the house was coming down. And the first instinct was grab the kids. We needed to get out of the house.
The city ordered all residents within a half mile to evacuate as the chemical fire that followed sent a black plume of smoke above the city. Troy Monk, director of health, safety, and security for TPC Group, spoke at a news conference.
The plume is what it is. I mean, it's a byproduct of burning hydrocarbons that we have in the facility, as well as burning metal. Burning grass, and anything else that the fire is consuming along the way.
The Texas Commission on Environmental Quality warned the burning chemicals can cause shortness of breath, headaches, and nausea. The EPA says it is monitoring air quality. And environmental advocates are warning these kinds of disasters could become more common because the Trump administration has been relaxing chemical safety regulations. Well, now let's get back to our conversation with Patrick Burley, who has a rare genetic mutation that caused him to go through puberty as a toddler. It's a condition called precocious puberty, or testotoxicosis.
I was about 3 years old, and I weighed as much and was as tall as a 7-year-old, and had the testosterone levels of a 14-year-old, mm-hmm. kind of deep in the throes of puberty.
Burley is now 40, and he wrote about his experience in January in New York Magazine and talked to us about it earlier this year. He told us his father had the same genetic mutation, so did his grandfather and his great-grandfather. I asked Patrick Burley about his great-grandfather, who looked so much older than he was that he lied about his age to join the Army, and Burley says he was the youngest American to serve in World War I.
He ran away from home at age 10. And, you know, kind of taken with patriotic fervor, he joined and he was shipped off to war and was like fighting in the trenches, fighting on the front lines by the time he was 11 and 12 years old.
Wow.
And they didn't discover his real age. He told them that he was 20 years old and he looked convincingly 20 years old at the time.
Amazing.
And he got drunk with some fellow soldiers and they took a cargo plane up. They essentially hijacked it and were kind of joyriding. And when it was grounded, he got in trouble. And as punishment, they sent him once more to the front and he suffered mustard gas poisoning and was hospitalized. And only then did the U.S. government discover that he was actually only 13 at the time. And they sent him home. He had a momentary, you know, flash of celebrity when the newspapers caught wind of the story and they dubbed him the youngest Yank.
Now, when you are telling the story in New York Magazine, you talk about how when you were deciding to have kids of your own, you wanted to test for this and try to remove this gene, if possible, so that your child wouldn't have to go through the same thing that you did and your father did and your grandfather and your great-grandfather did. Tell me a little bit about your thought process on that when you were thinking about what your kid's life would be like.
Well, you know, I didn't know when we were going through the process of thinking about having a child, I didn't know that it would be possible to test for this. It didn't occur to me. And my wife and I ended up doing in vitro fertilization, and we ended up with fertilized embryos. And my wife happens to be an endocrinologist. And so we found out that we could test the embryos for the LHCGR mutation. And so I was faced suddenly with this decision, you know, whether or not to select out for this mutation. And it feels like an obvious decision, right? Like, why would I ever wish the challenges that I endured on my own child? But it ended up being a lot more complex than that because, you know, this mutation for all of those struggles, it really kind of it defined me, you know. It defined my childhood and had a profound and lasting kind of impact on how I think about myself and probably the path that I've taken. And the same is true for my father and my grandfather and great grandfather. And so selecting out for that mutation, eliminating it from my lineage, it felt like, you know, eliminating this essential part of myself. And that was a feeling that was kind of, that surprised me. But it was present. And
your dad didn't want you to do it.
He didn't. And which kind of shocked me because, you know, having precocious puberty had been so traumatic for him that it's not like even something that he really wants to talk about with me. So I was surprised that he encouraged me not to do it. I mean, he would have supported me either way, but I think that he felt the same way that I did, you know, which is that it was very hard, but, you know, that's sort of that cliche, like what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. You know, and it led to this conversation, which I write about in the article, one of the first and only kind of conversations that we've ever had about our shared experiences having precocious puberty, in which he said to me, you know, your son, if he inherits this disease, he'll, you know, with you as his father, he'll be fine. And I have confidence in you as a parent. And so, you know, my wife and I, we talked about it a lot and sort of investigated all of our options. And in the end, we felt like we were capable of dealing with it and also that the treatment had sort of progressed far enough that our son, were he to inherit it, would be all right.
it reminds you of the Mr. Rogers saying, also kind of cliche, but very accurate, which is, I like you just the way you are.
Yeah, that's right. And it was definitely, it was moving to hear that from my father, and especially because I still, you know, and I think if I can speak for him, he does as well. Like, I still carry around this feeling of being a mutant in a way, like there's something wrong with me. So, yeah, so those words are meaningful.
And now you have two kids of your own. And as far as you know, neither of them has this genetic mutation.
That's right. So we rolled the dice with our son, and luckily he didn't inherit the mutation. And our daughter, who's a year and a half, we haven't tested her because the mutation doesn't manifest in women because you have to have testicles. Mm-hmm. So we'll either get her tested later or she'll test herself before she has her own children.
And when do you think you'll tell your son, if you haven't already, about your experience?
That's a good question. I don't know. I think maybe in a few years. He'll be four soon. And it's a pretty complex concept. But, you know, probably in the next few years, I think.
Well, it's an amazing story. What an experience you've had. And I must say, you are a fantastic writer, and people should check out your piece in New York Magazine, which we'll link to at hereandnow.org. That is Patrick Burley. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
In the past 6 years, there have been more than 8,000 cases of solitary confinement in immigrant detention centers across the U.S. That number has gone down in recent years, but the length of stay in some centers is still on average 50 days. The impacts can last even longer. Esme Jimenez from member station KUOW reports.
Raul always has a backwards baseball hat on, and behind his ear, a number 2 pencil. He works construction, building cabinets, so it's always handy. We're not using his real name because of his immigration status. Raul entered the U.S. illegally from Mexico with his wife and young kids in the early 2000s. Court records show that after a DUI, he ended up in detention at the Northwest Immigration and Customs Enforcement Processing Center in Tacoma, Washington. While there, he went on a hunger strike to protest conditions, like the food and treatment by guards. He ended up in solitary confinement.
El sufrimiento es, ya no es tanto físico, sino psicológico.
He says the suffering isn't really physical, but psychological. Not everyone can withstand being locked up alone. It's unclear if ICE put Raul in solitary to monitor his health or for disciplinary reasons. An ICE design standards manual indicates segregation rooms are 60 square feet. Raul describes his cell as a white brick room with no windows, about the size of a parking space.
Conforme va pasando el tiempo, es muy desesperante estar ahí.
He says it's maddening. As time passes, it's harder to be there. Raul thinks he was in solitary for 20 to 30 days. But he's not sure. He lost track of time. His immigration attorney confirms it was 20 days. He says the hallway lights were always on. Sometimes he heard people talking to themselves or yelling. When I ask if his time in detention changed him, he brushes it off. I ask instead, what do his friends say? His friends say he's quieter now, more reserved, and he stays in his room a lot. He says he wasn't like that before. Raul is one of 272 cases of solitary at ICE's Tacoma facility between 2013 to 2017. That's according to the public data obtained by the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. On average, detainees spent 51 days in isolation. The longest time was 781 days.
We used segregation as a last resort, if you will, to make sure that while someone is in our custody, their care remains at optimum level and that they are safe.
That's Natalie Asher. She's the Field Office Director for Immigration and Customs Enforcement in the Northwest. She points out that solitary is not just used for disciplinary reasons. For example, rival gang members are separated for their own protection. Other times, it's to monitor for medical issues, including someone on hunger strike. Detainees with mental health problems can also end up in segregation if there's not space in the medical unit.
They're being very, very closely monitored by our mental health staff. It may be best for the safety and, frankly, the monitoring and care of the detainee to be in administrative segregation.
A third of cases of solitary confinement between 2013 to 2017 had mental health flags on their profiles, according to public records. That means that at some point, either before, during, or after their stay in solitary, detainees showed symptoms of mental illness. Beth Farmer is a licensed clinical social worker who works with immigrants and refugees.
It is accepted that solitary confinement does make people's mental health symptoms much, much worse.
Part of Farmer's work is to conduct mental health evaluations for people's immigration cases. And she's evaluated several undocumented immigrants at the detention center in Tacoma.
There's some factors, like specifically related to depression, that isolation makes depression much worse. So I think that isolation, sense of helplessness, sense of hopelessness.
According to a report by the United Nations, solitary should only be used in rare cases and not at all for youth and individuals with mental illness. Back at Raul's apartment, the room is sparse. A couch, but no dining room table, no pictures on the wall. He spent 2.5 years in detention, and then he was eventually deported in 2016.
A raíz de todo eso, pues, me separé y me separé de mi familia. Y pues, cuando pierde uno todo ya.
Raúl says he lost everything. He couldn't stay connected to his 3 kids or wife. They eventually separated.
Yeah.
He says he lost his fear too, and just a few months after being deported, he came back.
For my kids. I need support them for get a better life.
Even if that means facing the risk of detention all over again. For Here and Now, I'm Esme Jimenez in Seattle.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I want to thank our holiday staff today, working instead of shopping on this Black Friday, although maybe some of them are shopping online. Frankie Perez, Tinku Ray, Todd Munt, Shiko Thiuri, Sam Rafelson, Serena McMahon, Alex Ashlock, Karen Miller-Medson, James Trout, Mike Moschetto, and Chris Ballman. I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now.